Well, we're talking about marriages, and last week we talked about Adam and Eve, and how none of us, when we got married, were told that we're at war. We're at war with our spouse, we're at war with Satan, because Satan knows that a marriage is his biggest threat in a community, and we've certainly seen that in the last few years as far as, I guess we're getting the handout now, so you guys will be able to keep up with me. We talked from the Old Testament about Adam and Eve and how Adam and Eve didn't include God in their decision to eat from the tree of good and evil. And how Adam was not at all surprised or shocked that the serpent was in the garden when he was the gardener and was supposed to keep track of things in the garden. And it was Adam's passiveness that he didn't say anything to Eve about what her plans were all about. And so that's what we started with last week. We talked a little about how to be a little bit better husbands, how four things can kill a marriage, criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. And that complaints were okay, but there needed to be an affirmation 5-to-1 ratio to be able to counter that, because all men are defensive. We are all by nature defensive. Today we take the New Testament into account, and we're going to hit some other issues about men. But I want to read from Luke's Gospel. And it says in chapter 7, when Jesus was finished saying all these in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. There was a centurion servant whose his master valued highly, and he was sick and was about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, "This man deserves to have you do this, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends saying to him, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I do not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself, a man under authority with soldiers, under me, and I tell this one, go, and he goes, and to that one, come, and he comes, and I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turned to the crowd following him, and said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel." Now, why is this an important verse for us as men? One is the saying that the man said, "For I myself am a man under authority." He does not say, "I am an authority." He says, "I'm a man under authority." And basically, he's a centurion. Now, a person who is in authority is under authority. And that's what this man is saying to Jesus. He's saying, "I know you too are an authority. You have authority to heal my servant." And today we're going to talk about men as being under authority. We, as husbands and leaders in our community, are men of authority. Whoops. Get it right here. Another cartoon. I think it's the Cap Slim. The cows don't see you as an authority figure. How many of you have authority issues? Anybody? Oh, just a few? I think all men have authority issues, you know? I don't know about you, but I can turn on my computer and it'll ask for the password, and I type in the password, and sometimes it rejects me and says, "Have you forgotten your password?" And I get angry at that. That little, right? I say, I can't believe it. You know, I feel threatened by this computer that's chiding me that I don't even know my own password. And as men, we tend to come up against authority, and we sometimes want to challenge authority. You know, you have a policeman pull over your car, and immediately, you know, there's a reaction that you have. Oftentimes, it's not good. You know, some of those, you know, world's funniest videos are videos of cops that come up and, you know, are interviewing these people. Guys get out of their car and start yelling and screaming. And we, as men, have authority issues. But we are all under authority. We, as Christians, have submitted our life to Jesus Christ. Therefore, we are under authority. But we are also a part of a hierarchy. And that hierarchy has God at the top. Jesus submitted to God the Father's authority, came to the earth, and saved us. But we as Christians, as Christian men, are called to authority under Jesus. And our wives under ourselves, and actually children under parents in that way. But why? Why does God work with a hierarchy? That's a real good, important question to ask, because a lot of Christians are probably looked on with disdain because we know that in Ephesians 5:25 that men are to be over their wives, and women are to submit to their husbands. Now, why is that? Now, the answer is in the issue of protection. God wants you protected. When Paul talks about the different women in the church that should wear hats over their heads, the issue is that they are identified as protected under the care of a man. And as you come to church, you are protected under a church. That's how God designed it. It is not necessarily to be something that we lord over our wives. It's because we are a part of an army. And this army has rank, and it has responsibility. And you as a husband, or a leader in this church, a man in this church, you have authority. Now, we don't talk about that much. But you're part of an army. And you have a rank. And you have a responsibility. And that's what's so important as a secondary to what I was talking about last week. We as a church have sometimes not focused on our authority as men, to be able to lead our church, lead our families, and we see what happens in a society where men do not pick up that ball. Because there are really only two choices. The choice of obedience. You can either submit to God or oppose God. The world is divided up into these two camps. There is no neutral. There is no Switzerland in God's economy when it comes to spiritual things. Either you have submitted to God or you oppose Him. So our camp, as we have submitted to God, has to be very clear about when we submit to God and we are obedient to Him, then we have to understand our place. Now, I believe as a church, we have a wonderful time at this time in the world to be able to be different, you know? We read about in 1st and 2nd Peter how to be holy, how to be set apart. Well, we get to do that now. We get to be so different than the world, both in how we treat the community, but also our wives. Now, if God has given us authority, how then are we to treat our wives? Ever washed your wife's feet? Ever died for her? Jesus did. As we read in Ephesians, Jesus says, Paul writes in 5:25, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, set apart, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself." That is our obedience. We have to love our wives. It isn't a suggestion. It's actually a command. We are to love our wives. Now, I think it's hard because, for the most part, it's hard for men to get their arms around loving their wife. We know how to do things for our wives. We know how to provide for our wives. But oftentimes, and I mentioned this last week, oftentimes we miss the mark as far as what our wives really want from us. Another little cartoon. I like these cartoons. "Look, I can't promise I'll change, but I can promise that I'll pretend to change." Right? Sometimes we find ourselves in that role. We don't quite know what women want. We're baffled at why they want us to be connected with them. Why isn't it just enough that I go out and I get a lot of money? And as we studied last week, when the money runs out, then what do you got? And that really becomes then the we show what we're all about as Christian men. We got more than just a fastball. We've got a slider and everything else, because when the money's gone, we actually get better. That's what we should look like as a Christian community of men. Now, what does the Bible teach us about love? Well, in 1 Corinthians, the hallmark of love is patience, kindness. Love does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. Now, interesting that those three are together. It's not envious, it doesn't boast, and it's not proud. As a psychologist, I look at that. Envy, pride, and boasting are all, to me, very primitive emotions. Envy basically says, if I can't have it, I will destroy it. Boasting, of course, puts you aside from others, that you're different and special. And being proud, of course, we understand that pride is that disease that all of us have. Deep down inside, it's hard for us to submit and be obedient to God. And Satan led us on a path saying, you don't need God. You can be just like God. But for all of us, we know, as much as we want to be, we'll never be that. And that our true relationship with God is one where we're submitting to him. Love is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered, and it keeps no records of wrong. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. Now, that's interesting. Love does not delight in evil. You'd think it'd be love delights in good, but what he says here is, but it rejoices in truth, because what does truth do? Truth reveals things. Whereas evil is out to destroy, truth is open to showing what the truth is about. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres, love never fails. Now, we've always heard this at funerals, we've heard it at weddings, we've heard this chapter, but I want you as husbands and leaders in the church to be able to grab hold of this today, because these are your marching orders as far as it comes to your wife. How do I learn how to become more patient and kind? How do I not let anger overwhelm me? And how I don't keep track of everything all the time. And that love always protects. There's one thing that we as husbands have to do, and it's part of this hierarchy thing. We have to protect our wives. So it's really important to be able to understand that love, that's what love does. Love is about being mature. Love is about being like Christ, a suffering servant. Before I get into what it means to be a suffering servant, all of us wonder about our wives. Sometimes our wives say, "Couldn't you at least try and read my mind?" Oftentimes we have wives that feel that we don't even try to understand them. And part of being a good husband is a model of a suffering servant. Many of you in the 70s, there was a movie that came out, and the movie basically said, "Love means you never have to say you're sorry." Remember that? I forgot who was in the Love Story. That's it. Love Story. And so the definition seemed kind of interesting. Love means you never have to say you're sorry, which on one hand meant maybe you're so close that you know each other so well, but that's hardly the case in our relationships. We're never that close to our wives where we never have to say we're sorry. Now, these are the things that I consider to be important as far as being a leader in your home, a suffering servant in your home, and how you'll set yourself apart from the rest of the community. Be a student of your wife. Study your wife like your golf game. Know where the sand traps are. Right? Know what you can hit, you know? Remember when Phil Nicholson at Pebble Beach took out his driver and hit it on 18 as his second shot, and everybody just gasped because, you know, Phil gets up there and he's on the fairway, he's got his driver out, and you're going, "Whoa, if you can hit this, this is going to be amazing." But of course he didn't. Pulls it into the sea, and all of us have to know what we can do in our marriage like a golf game. It's, you know, there's certain things we're really good at. Never out your wife in public. Now, I had a horrible experience on a trip one time where I was with a group of people, and we decided, there were about 15 of us, there were 16 of us, because we're all couples, on this trip, and we decided to play a game, and the game was, "I've never done this." And the deal is that once you say it, then those who are standing who have done that have to stay standing. And everybody else sits down. And so this guy says, "I have never smoked marijuana," knowing that his wife had, and nobody in the group would have guessed it. He outed his wife in public. And I'll never forget the look on her face. How could you? Now, she could have probably sat down and nobody would have known, but she was such a good person. She stood. Never out your wife in public. You have to protect her. That means taking advantage of whatever weakness that she has. We have to protect our wives. Now, listen. Don't just wait to talk or solve her problems. With our wives, we basically think of ourselves as problem solvers. And sometimes maybe we have a relationship with our wives where they ask us a lot of detailed questions, but there are a lot of times wives just want to be listened to. And so what I suggest men do is, if you can listen for really content and feelings and just be able to kind of echo that back at them without evaluating it, it's amazing what they will do. There's a reason why women like other women, because they do this really well. They listen to each other very well. We don't do that so well. Instead, we figure we're going to help them out. Maybe they're not so smart, so we're going to help them out. I don't believe any of your wives need that kind of help. I think what they need is a humble man who will listen and help understand them and protect them. Because if you don't, someone else will. And that'll come to our last one. The next one is repair statements. This is a hard one to get through to men. Because when you argue with your wife, most of us are trying to figure out what we're going to say next. You know, we already plan our defense, and we're already ready to out-argue them. But a repair statement basically allows the conversation to go a little bit further. Now, I'll give you an example. The one I have up there is, you could be right. Now, if your wife is kind of chattering at you and you happen to say, you know, you could be right, you'll be surprised how her demeanor will change. If you're not defensive and you say, gosh, I never thought of it that way, you know, you could be right. Because she's used to you being defensive and attacking and justifying your position. But with our wives, we want longer conversations. Here's another one. Here's another repair statement that I often use. You know you wouldn't intentionally hurt me, but when you said this, I felt bad. We give our wives the benefit of the doubt that they are good people. I know you wouldn't intentionally hurt me, but when you said this, I really felt bad. That model allows you to be truthful to your wife, but open. There's several ways that you can allow your wife to speak longer without giving up what you feel is your territory. And as men, we're really good at business, we're really good at negotiation, we're really good at solving things. But sometimes we forget that I believe that God is going to say, what did you do with the first authority that I gave you? The first authority that I gave you was your wife. How did you act with her? How did you protect her? How did you encourage her? How did you die for her? How did you wash her feet? How did you act like Jesus in all of that? Another part is turning toward her. There's something very subtle about when your wife talks, you turn toward her. You don't ignore her. You don't pretend like you didn't hear anything. You turn toward her. You meet her. Your eyes meet. Your hands touch. You turn toward your wife. Subtle things. But the opposite destroys relationship. So, you know, as your wife talks, you turn toward her. You engage her. You don't kind of, you put down the paper. You engage her in that way. And perhaps the next is probably the most important, which is praying with your wife. Now, we've said it before, but it's one of these kinds of things that to me is so profoundly important in this day and age, which is praying with your wife solidifies your kingdom. Leading and praying with your wife is the most important thing I think you can do. Because it basically says to her, I'm the leader, and I know how important it is to include God in our relationship. All marriages are a triangle. It's a trinity, man, wife, and God. And as we bring God into the equation, your wife will respect you so much. She will be so happy that she doesn't have to lead. She will admire you. She will praise you. She will tell her friends about it. But I think it's the hardest thing for men to do because, A, we say to ourselves, we don't pray well, you know? I just don't have the words. But to me, it's not the words. It's the attitude. It's the ability to come forth and say, you know what? This is what it takes to be a leader. This is what it takes to lead my wife, to lead my family, lead my community, to pray with my wife. Because you know what? It humbles us. It humbles us to be in the same position, just as Jesus prayed for his church. We are to pray for our wives and our family. That alone will set you aside from the community. And you know what? It doesn't have to be very long. My wife and I do it like this. Every other night, I will lead and I just pray about what's going on in the day, what challenges we're facing, what praises we want to share with God. And it could be like 30 seconds. And then Anne prays the next night. Now, we pray in bed just before we go to sleep. And we hold hands, and it's become a ritual that for us, if we don't do it, it feels odd. It feels like something's missing. And then one of us will say, wait, we didn't pray. We didn't connect spiritually. So if you get anything from this today, it's praying with your wife. And the last is set loving boundaries with your wife. Now, those might be financial boundaries. They might be gossip boundaries, you know. Women tend to like to talk a lot. Sometimes we can be kind of the muffler in that and say, hold it, are you supposed to be talking about other people in that way? We have to see what's going on in our family. And we can't leave the back door open. Now, what do I mean by that? That means if you don't do the others, you're leaving the back door open. That someone will come along and fill that need. I've been a therapist for 27 years. I can't tell you how many thousands of affairs I've dealt with. Men and women. Be surprised how many women initiated the affair. And you know what it was about? It wasn't about sex. It was about being understood. It was about being cared for. It was about being nurtured. That's what it means to leave the back door open. You've got to nurture your wife. Love her. Be a student of her. You've got to look at her as someone that needs to be protected and cared for. You need to insulate your relationship with her so that nobody else could possibly find their way into her life. And being able to set good boundaries can probably even look like this. For heaven's sakes, Melissa, she's my mother. I can't tell her to leave. Now, Many of you probably have had issues like that, where mothers or mother-in-laws kind of get involved in your relationship as husband and wife, and sometimes we have to set certain boundaries that say, you know, as men we're called to leave and to cleave, and sometimes we have to join with our wife and pull her away from a family, or maybe we need to be pulled away in that way. But here are some questions I want. I want to give you a little bit more time today. Last time we didn't have as much time. But in what ways can I better protect my wife? Second, in what ways do I fail to listen to my wife? And the last question is, in what ways do I fail to lead my wife? So I want you to join a table and discuss these questions as God is calling us to be set apart from the world, to be the best husbands and leaders that we can be. Go ahead and take a few minutes to do that.